You know, there's this moment that happens to, well, almost everyone who climbs the ladder at work. You finally get the promotion. You're the supervisor. You've got the team. You've got the targets, the schedule. And the immediate just crushing pressure is get the work out the door.
Right. Keep the wheels turning. That is always the mandate.
Exactly. But then usually in your first week, someone drops this massive dusty binder on your desk. Or I guess these days they forward you a link to some dense, impossible to navigate folder on the server.
Yeah, the dreaded shared drive.
Right. And it's all about WHS systems, workplace health and safety. And look, be honest, the instinct is to groan, shove it on a shelf, and get back to the real work.
That is the classic reaction. I mean, WHS often feels like this bureaucratic tax you just have to pay to be allowed to manage people. It feels completely separate from the actual job you were hired to do.
But today, for this deep dive, we are looking at a source text titled Supervising Workplace Health and Safety Systems. And it argues the exact opposite of that.
It really does.
It suggests that if you view that binder as just paperwork, you are missing the most critical part of your job. It claims that a supervisor isn't just a production manager. They are effectively a safety architect.
A safety architect. That's a really strong term. But looking at this document, it actually fits perfectly. This source material, which is essentially a competency unit for leaders, is a blueprint.
Yeah.
It's designed to bridge the gap between the boardroom, where all the policies are written in nice, clean, legal language, and the shop floor, where things are messy and loud and potentially very dangerous.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to unpack the five pillars of safety supervision that are outlined in this text. That's information, consultation, training, hazard management, and record keeping.
Right.
But we aren't just going to list them like a textbook. We need to figure out how you actually do them without bringing production to a grinding halt.
Which is the ultimate tension, isn't it? Production versus safety. It's the eternal workplace struggle.
It really is. And actually, the source addresses that tension right out of the gate with a fascinating distinction. It says this specific unit applies to people who provide guidance to others, but who have, and this is a quote, limited responsibility for the output of others.
Yeah, that is a very specific, almost strange legal phrasing to find in a document like this. Limited responsibility for output.
What do you make of that? Because, I mean, most supervisors I know feel absolute unlimited responsibility for output. If the numbers are down at the end of the shift, they're the ones getting hauled into the office.
I think it's trying to legally insulate the safety role, or at least compartmentalize it for the sake of this competency standard.
Okay, how so?
Well, it's saying, in the eyes of this specific safety framework, we don't care how many widgets you made today. We care entirely about the environment in which you made them. It frames the supervisor as a filter.
A filter, I like that.
Yeah, you are the person responsible for meeting legislative requirements on the ground. If the company is the brain making the policy, you are the hands actually enforcing it.
I love that image. The supervisor as the filter. So let's get right into the first layer of this filter. Pillar number one, the information gateway. The text explicitly says a supervisor must provide information to the work team about WHS policies and procedures.
Sounds simple enough on paper. For the company-wide email, put the laminated poster up in the break room. Job done.
You'd think so. But the text adds a qualifier that changes everything. It says the information must be readily accessible.
Ah, yes, the accessibility trap. This is where a lot of organizations completely fail.
Right, because let's be real. If the safety procedure for a chemical spill is on a shared drive that requires a two-factor authentication password, and the guy working the night shift doesn't even have a computer login,
then it's not accessible. And in a legal sense, you haven't provided the information at all. You've basically hidden it.
So the dusty binder in the lock manager's office is out.
It's definitely out. The source material is pushing for accessibility right at the point of need. If I'm standing in front of a heavy-duty lathe and I need to know the safe operating procedure, I shouldn't have to walk to another building or call a manager to wake them up to find it.
He needs to be right there.
Exactly. It needs to be integrated into the workspace.
There's another layer here, too, that really stood out to me. The translation factor.
Oh, this is vital.
Yeah. The text demands that supervisors explain relevant WHS information clearly and accurately and in an appropriate structure and language.
That is huge, because it's acknowledging that WHS laws are written by lawyers for lawyers, but they apply to welders, to nurses, chefs, retail staff.
So if I just stand up during a morning toolbox talk and read the WHS Act to my team verbatim, I'm failing.
You are absolutely failing. That's just white noise to them. The appropriate language part means you have to strip away the corporate jargon. You have to take a phrase like, say, hierarchy of control regarding ergonomic hazards, and you have to translate it to, here is how we lift this heavy box so we don't blow a disc in our back before lunch.
It's almost like you have to be bilingual as a supervisor. You need to speak corporate and you need to speak human.
That's a perfect way to put it. You are the interpreter. And the source actually gives a very specific list of what you need to translate.
It does. It's not just general vibes like, hey guys, be careful out there today.
Exactly. You need to communicate the specific relevant provisions of the laws, the identified hazards. So what exactly in this specific room can hurt you? And interestingly, the outcomes of risk assessments.
I paused on that one too when I was reading it. Outcomes of risk assessments. That implies you have to show your work to the team.
It does. Usually managers just say, wear these safety goggles. That's a command.
Right. Do it because I said so.
But sharing the outcome of the risk assessment means saying, look, we analyzed this machine. We realized it throws metal shards at high velocity. And we calculated that without goggles, you have a 40% chance of losing an eye.
It gives them the why.
It's all about the why. Adults do not like following arbitrary rules. They follow logic. If you explain the risk assessment, you're treating them like partners in safety, not like children you're just bossing around. You're giving them the respect of understanding the actual danger.
Which flows perfectly into pillar two, because you can't treat people like partners if you're doing all the talking. The text calls for supervisors to implement and monitor work team consultative arrangements.
Consultation, probably the most misused word in corporate safety.
Oh, absolutely. Usually means I talk, you listen, and then you sign the attendance sheet so I can prove to HR that I talked to you.
Precisely. But the source material is adamant about this. Consultation is a mechanism. It's a tool for extracting critical data. Think about it. Who knows where the guardrail on the walkway is loose? Who knows which forklift has those sticky brakes?
The person driving the forklift. The person leaning on the rail every single day.
Right, but they won't tell you if you don't have a robust, trusting consultation mechanism. The text says you must communicate the importance of consultation.
Meaning what?
You basically have to sell your team on the idea that raising safety flags is a good thing. It's not snitching. It's not slowing down the job.
That is a massive cultural shift, though. In a lot of workplaces, raising a safety issue is seen as complaining. It's like, stop whining and just get the job done. We have a quota.
And that's exactly where the supervisor creates the culture. The text puts a very heavy duty on you here. You must contribute to managing issues raised through consultation. That implies real action.
Right. If someone raises their hand and says, hey, this ladder is wobbly, and you just say, okay, noted, and then 3 weeks later, the ladder is still wobbly.
Then consultation is dead. You've just proven to your team that it's a complete waste of time.
You taught them that speaking up achieves nothing.
You killed the culture. The source says you have to resolve the issue according to organizational procedures. Or, if you can't fix it yourself, you refer it up to management. And, this is the absolute kicker, you must communicate outcomes of consultation back to the team. You have to close the loop.
So you have to say, hey, you told me about the ladder. I submitted the request. We ordered a new one, and it arrives on Tuesday.
Yes. You have to prove the system actually works. You have to prove that their voice has power. If you do that consistently, they'll tell you about the next hazard before it actually hurts someone.
Okay, so we've got information going out to the team and consultation coming in from the team. Now let's look at pillar three, the educator. The text says supervisors must implement and monitor WHS training.
And before everyone listening tunes out because they're thinking about those incredibly boring PowerPoint presentations in a stuffy back room, the source is actually quite specific about what training means in this context. It starts with a gap analysis.
A gap analysis. The text says you have to identify and document team needs.
Right. You are looking at the difference between what the law and the company say your team needs to know and what your team actually knows how to do.
So if you have a new guy on the floor, does he know how to handle the new chemical solvent?
Exactly. If not, that's a gap. And you, as the supervisor, own that gap. You can't just assume they know because they nodded during the interview or because they had a certificate from 5 years ago.
But here's the reality check for a lot of people listening. Most supervisors aren't professional trainers. They don't have the time or the skills to run formal courses.
And the source totally acknowledges that. If you look down in the knowledge section of the document, it lists features of effective workplace learning. It doesn't just say send them to a classroom. It specifically highlights coaching and mentoring assistance.
Coaching and mentoring. See, that feels way more organic. That feels like something that naturally happens on the floor during a shift.
It is. It's the veteran worker showing the rookie the ropes safely. The supervisor's job, according to the text, is to make arrangements with stakeholders.
So you facilitate the learning.
Right. Maybe you aren't the one teaching the advanced forklift course, but you are the one ensuring that Bob is paired with Sarah for his first week on the floor, because you know Sarah is your safest, most experienced operator.
I really like that distinction. You aren't necessarily the teacher, but you are the architect of the learning environment. You make sure the knowledge transfer actually happens.
Yes, because if an accident happens due to a lack of training, saying, "I thought HR handled that during onboarding," is not a legal defense. You are responsible for the competency of the people operating in your area.
That is a heavy weight to carry. But Pillar 4 feels even heavier, honestly. This is the detective phase. The text requires identifying hazards and assessing and controlling risks.
This is the core duty. If you stripped away all the paperwork, all the committee meetings, this is the part that actually keeps people alive. And the source introduces a concept here that is absolutely fundamental to WHS, but is so often misunderstood: the hierarchy of control measures.
Okay, let's break this down for the listener who hasn't memorized the safety textbook, because I think a lot of people assume safety just means PPE, personal protective equipment. You know, hand out the hard hats, the steel toe boots, the gloves, and we're good.
Right. And that is a very dangerous assumption. The hierarchy of control is a ranking of effectiveness. Imagine you have a massive, incredibly noisy generator on the shop floor that is actively damaging people's hearing. The bottom of the hierarchy, the absolute least effective solution, is PPE, giving everyone a pair of cheap earplugs.
But wait, why is that the least effective? It stops the noise from hurting them, doesn't it?
Only if they wear them perfectly, every single time. And it doesn't remove the hazard itself. It just puts a tiny, flimsy barrier between the hazard and the worker. If the earplug falls out, or if they forget to put it in because they're rushing, the protection is completely gone. The hazard is still roaring away.
That makes sense.
The text says supervisors need to implement procedures using this hierarchy. So you shouldn't start at the bottom with earplugs. You should be looking at the top.
So what's at the top? Walk us through it.
Level 1 is elimination. Can we just get rid of the generator entirely? Do we even need it? Level 2 is substitution. Can we swap it out and buy a newer, quieter generator? Level 3 is engineering controls. Can we build a heavy soundproof box around the generator?
Okay, I see.
Then level 4 is administration. Can we rotate the shifts so that nobody is working near that machine for more than an hour a day?
And then, only after you've failed at all of those higher levels do you hand out the earplugs.
Correct. The supervisor needs to be constantly pushing up that hierarchy. Instead of just saying, "Why aren't you wearing your dust mask?" you should be asking, "Why is there so much dust? Can't we install a vacuum extraction system instead?"
That requires a really proactive mindset. You're not just a hall monitor enforcing rules. You're actively critiquing the system. Which brings up a specific requirement of the text that I found really compelling. It says you must identify and report inadequacies in existing risk controls.
Yes. I call this the nothing lasts forever clause.
Meaning what exactly? But
meaning that safety solutions degrade over time. That soundproof box we built around the generator, maybe it's been 5 years and the acoustic foam inside has rotted away. Maybe the latch on the door is broken so it hangs open. It was a fantastic control 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But now it's an inadequacy. The supervisor has to spot that decay.
Or maybe the team has found a workaround. We've all seen that happen.
Oh, the classic workaround. Hey, the safety sensor on this press slows the machine down by 2 seconds, so we just taped a piece of cardboard over it. Or the guardrail makes it annoying to change the drill bit, so we unbolted it.
Right.
That is a glaring inadequacy in the control. And here's the brutal truth. If you, as the supervisor, walk past that taped over sensor and you say nothing, you have just accepted a new higher level of risk for your team.
You've essentially authorized the danger.
You have. By your silence, you've become completely complicit in the workaround.
Wow. There is another term in the knowledge section regarding this detective work that we need to touch on. Assessing implications of near misses.
The near miss, truly the most valuable free data your company will ever get.
Why do you call it free data?
Because an actual accident costs you dearly. It costs physical pain for the worker, it crushes team morale, it costs a fortune in downtime, and it brings in legal fees. A near miss costs absolutely nothing, but it tells you exactly where your next major accident is going to happen.
But the problem is, human nature is to just wipe our brow, say, "Phew, that was close," and move on. No harm, no foul.
Exactly. Hey, the pallet of bricks fell from the top rack, but it didn't hit anybody, so let's just sweep it up before the boss sees.
Right.
The source text says no, you cannot do that. You need to assess the implications. If a massive pallet falls and lands exactly where a worker was standing 10 seconds ago, your incident report shouldn't be messy floor cleaned up. The report is potential workplace fatality due to stacking failure.
That is a massive shift in mindset.
Yeah.
You aren't reporting what actually happened. You're reporting what could have happened.
And the text goes further. It requires you to monitor the outcomes of reports. If you report that near miss, hey management, that rack system is totally unstable and the maintenance team doesn't come out to fix it.
You have to follow up. You have to be the squeaky wheel.
You have to be the squeaky wheel, because if that rack falls on someone next Tuesday and you have a paper trail showing that you reported it, but you just let it drop when management ignored you, that is a very bad day in court for everyone involved.
Which brings us perfectly to the final pillar, the one everyone dreads, the historian, record keeping. The text demands you implement and monitor WHS records.
The paperwork.
Yeah.
But let's reframe it. It's not just paperwork, it's evidence. Obviously, you have to complete records for occupational injury and disease. That's just basic law. If someone gets hurt, you log it. But the source goes deeper. It talks about using aggregate information and data.
Aggregate information. That sounds a bit like corporate big data jargon. What does that actually mean for a supervisor walking the floor?
It means you have to start connecting the dots. Look, if you have one slip and fall incident in the north hallway, it's an accident. Someone was clumsy. But if you have three near-miss reports of slippery floors in that exact same hallway, and it's always happening at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday,
then you have a pattern.
Exactly. Maybe the cleaning crew mops that specific area at 1:50 p.m. Or maybe there's a condensation leak that only happens when the big AC unit cycles on in the afternoon. The aggregate data tells you the real story that a single, isolated incident report simply cannot.
So the supervisor needs to be looking at the logbook not just as a chore to fill out at the end of the week, but as a text to read to find the trends.
Yes. The records inform your risk assessment, which then informs your training needs. It's a completely closed loop. If you aren't keeping meticulous records, you are flying blind. You are just reacting to accidents after they happen instead of predicting them.
Now, before we wrap up these five pillars, we do need to zoom out to the broader legal context that the source establishes. It throws around some legal acronyms, specifically PCBU.
Yes, the PCBU. It stands for Person Conducting a Business or Undertaking.
That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It really is. But in modern WHS law, particularly in places like Australia, where this specific terminology is very common, the PCBU is usually the company itself.
Yeah.
The overarching legal entity. It's a broad term because it covers more than just traditional employers. It covers franchises, principal contractors, things like that.
Got it.
The source wants the supervisor to deeply understand this chain of command. The PCBU, the company, has the primary duty of care. They are the ones with the budget, the resources, the overarching power. The officers, meaning the executives, have a duty to exercise due diligence. The workers have a duty to take reasonable care of their own safety.
And where does the supervisor fit in all that?
You are the linchpin. You are the one translating the PCBU's resources and policies into the worker's daily reality on the floor.
And the source also mentions you need to know the difference between Commonwealth and state or territory laws.
Yes. It's a stark reminder that you can't just operate your floor on common sense. You need to know which specific legislative act covers your actual physical site. Is it federal jurisdiction? Is it state? Because when things go horribly wrong, the specific wording of the specific act is what the investigators are going to use. Ignorance of the law is not a defense, even for a frontline supervisor. You have to know the playing field.
So let's try to synthesize all of this. We started this deep dive by asking if a supervisor is just a production pusher. Having gone through this source material, that idea seems, well, dangerously incomplete.
Dangerously is the right word.
You are an information gateway. You are a consultation facilitator. You are an educator. You are a detective hunting for hazards. And you are a historian tracking the data.
And remember that weird phrase from the very beginning, limited responsibility for the output of others. It really highlights that your true value in this specific context isn't speed, it's sustainability. If you drive your team so incredibly hard to meet a production target that someone gets crushed by a forklift, you have failed in your primary legislative duty.
It's a massive responsibility. You really are the guardian of the system.
You are. And honestly, it is the most important job in the building. Because think about it, if production stops, the company loses some money. But if safety stops, families lose people. It really is that simple.
That is a very sobering thought to end on.
Well, it actually leads me to one final provocation, something I want the listener to really consider after this deep dive.
Well, let's hear it.
We talked heavily about the hierarchy of control, elimination, substitution, engineering controls, and we talked about your duty to report inadequacies.
Right, the detective work.
So here is the tension that this source text dances around but doesn't explicitly solve for you. What happens if you, as the supervisor, do your job perfectly? You spot a hazard, you analyze it, you say, hey, this machine needs a $10,000 safety guard. And the PCBU, the company, looks at your report and says, no, we don't have the budget for that this quarter.
Oh, wow.
You have done your duty by reporting it, you've kept your records, but the hazard is still sitting there on the floor.
That puts the supervisor in a terrible, almost impossible position. Do you let your team keep working on that machine?
And that is the ultimate test of a safety architect. The text implies a duty to control risks. If you can't control it because the company won't pay to fix it, do you have the sheer authority and the courage to stop the line?
To literally press the big red button.
Exactly. If you know a process is fundamentally unsafe and you let your team work anyway just because the boss said so, where do you legally and morally stand when it goes wrong? This text strongly suggests that your core role is to ensure safety limits production risks. So, the question is, are you willing to be the one who stands up and says, stop?
That is something for every single supervisor listening to chew on during their next shift. It's not just about following the rules in a binder. It's about having the resolve to enforce them when it is deeply inconvenient for the business. Well, we hope this deep dive has given you a totally fresh perspective on that dense WHS manual sitting on your shelf. It's not just a stack of paper, it's your shield, and it is your team's survival guide.
Stay safe out there, everyone.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. See you next time.